The great Bucky Fuller once said, "The best way to predict the future is to invent it." Galit Arial, author of Augmenting Alice, The Future of Identity, Experience, and Reality, is an extraordinary human inventing futures that augment, virtualize, and extend our realities. Her approach offers a far more creative and equitable way to use these technologies to make science fiction science realities.
I'm a total immersive, you know, I want to say I'm an anthropological creative. And I feel if, with every project I take, I try not just to learn about it on paper, but really to get myself inside, you know, the mind of the company, but also the people experiencing it. So I've done pretty interesting tours of my life. And whenever I want to say I find an area that fascinates me, or I feel I can continue my practice in, I dive in. So I turned into education in the Netherlands. I was heading a department of a branding department and was doing my master's at the same time. And that's when immersive tech, augmented reality kind of resurfaced. I was busy with it more in my studies before in my BA. And that was the moment where it resurfaced. And like my life became complete because it was the hybrid of physical world and computer interaction and behaviors that kind of came together for me. And this is my happy place. I think I finally, at my late age, I finally found my home where I could bring together everything that I've done before. And, you know, knowledge never goes to waste, right?
That's fantastic. Finding happiness is, there's something to it. And often we're always chasing it. But when you find it at that intersection of both being able to love, you know, what you do, the making piece of it, and then having the financial benefits behind it is also no easy feat at all.
Well, you know, financially, it's not as lucrative. You know, running your own business and creating your own projects is definitely not as lucrative as working in a fixed job, in a corporate job. And I used to call it my horrible 30s. It was my horrible 30s is when I tried to conform and I said, oh, I have to be an adult now, I think. And I took the big jobs and the big projects for money. You know, they were still in the area that I was doing. And I don't want to say I was unhappy, but or I didn't learn anything, but it wasn't where my heart was at. And at a certain point, actually, when I hit 40, at least for me, I was like, okay, from now on, it's like me walking to the grave. Not so ominous. I'm not afraid of death, but I'm like, this is the rest of my life now. Mm-hmm. Am I doing what I really feel I should be doing? Is it truly making me happy? My answer was no. And I made a conscious decision to follow my conviction. And of course it had financial hurdles because when you carve your own path, it's a completely different road. You have to carve it on yourself. It means that you have to invest resources, both financial, but also creative and emotional in order to build that world. And there's no guarantee, you know, you will succeed. So I took that path very consciously. I feel like I can impact more at the moment by doing, you know, things that are not in the conventional path.
Sure. And I think it's different risk taking, right? To your point in 30s, it was like, now I must establish myself as not necessarily a corporate wonk to your point, but much more of, well, I could work at one of these places, but, you know, in your 40s, being able to choose, pick and choose what
you are creating, how you are creating, and inevitably being the owner of its impact, I think is a really interesting space.
Yeah, definitely. And again, it's not just choosing what you do, but also who you do it with. Mm. And I'm a big people's person. I like to call it like the tribe of awesome. And the moment I unleashed myself from these boundaries, the tribe, I really have a group of people around me, and that I want to say a mind hive of people that want to do the same things, and we help each other directly and indirectly for a greater cause, let's say, or for a joint creative vision. And it's been, that's been fantastic. These are my people, and that's what keeps me going, because there are massive, downsides on doing things on your own.
Talk to me, let's go back to a little bit. When did you know you were this, When I look at your work and I understand more and more about who you are, I see you as an entrepreneur, an inventor, a designer. Ultimately, you're a creator. And I think all humans are creators, but you have a gift for that creation in a very specific space of AR, VR, and extended reality. Am I correct in saying that?
Yes, I think extended reality, poking at reality, you know, when people ask me what I do, I poke at reality is my best answer. And I think I was always, as Gaga said, I was born this way. I always looked at things and questioned why are they like that, and didn't necessarily accept because that's the way it is. And I didn't accept this can't be done or this is the way it is, and tried to find alternative ways to why is it the way it is and can we do it differently? So I think this is how I got into design. I was questioning, I want to say, the physical world, you know, from aesthetics to function. That's why I was attracted to the digital world, because all of a sudden physical boundaries of making collapsed. Because you could do so many realistic or reality-like experiences in through digital means, and the marriage of that for me is the ultimate. This is the ultimate prize, you know. Augmented reality in my lifetime is my nerd dream since I was a kid and reading sci-fi. I was a mega nerd. So being able to live in an era where science fiction is becoming a tool that is accessible, not just for researchers in universities or labs of big corps, but to everyone, is what fascinates me the most. And the question of how we will apply it in reality, not in the minds of VCs, how will we use it for better, worse, and especially the weird, is really, for me, this is my life's reward, being able to live in this era, mm-hmm. where we unlock these different realms, what's happening through our neural perception, through our physical interactions and our digital communication and space making.
What was that path to this space of poking reality, of taunting different realities?
I can pinpoint, because I'm reading this book again now, I can pinpoint it to a specific life event, and that's me reading The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I think that, I mean, up until then, I was reading science fiction, and it was, you know, science fiction, like the robots will have cognition, etc. And then came Douglas Adams into my life, and I read the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was, and still is, in my mind, one of the most mind-blowing, the real science fiction of science fiction, almost like the metaphysics of science fiction. And it's a book that a lot of people read as kind of like a comedic science fiction book, because it is funny. But that pokes so many holes in the assumptions that we have as humans about, you know, human supremacy, In the book, actually, mice are experimenting on humans, just letting us believe that we're experimenting on them. There's so many twists and turns and, you know, the improbability engine that runs the spaceship, this idea that is beyond, I want to say, the linear path of science. And it really injects all these, I want to say, cosmic, again, I don't want to sound like a new ager, but like cosmic influence of science being part of bigger systems that are also biological, that are also behavioral, that are also based on vice and ego. I think that book forever changed my life.
It's just brilliant. It's one of those books that it is one of those, it just looks at a world, maybe in the way that we didn't think the world could exist.
Yeah.
And so it was much more of a mind bending experience for me, certainly. And so much became derivative out of it.
Yeah. And I've just have a newfound appreciation to it. I actually just now finished an animation short that is based on one of the ideas in the book, not indirectly, which is probably, I want to say, an unexpected. I'm not an animator, but I ended up doing the Unreal Virtual Production Fellowship, and as an end product, you're asked to do an animation. And you know, a lot of the people there coming from gaming. There's a lot of, you know, space, robots, zombie stuff. They're brilliantly done, and my short that is coming out this week is about a disembodied nipple trying to live its best nipple life on an alien planet, and it's based on one of like a little extract from the book where he talks about ballpoint pens or Bic pens that it's kind of like a way to explain why they disappear, you know, from our pockets, is because they slip back into their ballpoint world where they live their best ballpoint life, which I found fascinating, hilarious, because again, we take objects for granted of being unanimated, free of will or free of agency. And all of a sudden he just comes and flips it on its head and saying like, no, they have the secret life of ballpoint pens. And I'm like, oh my God, this is brilliant. And I read it again just before I started fellowship, and I'm like, what if our nipples wanted to know why we keep pixelating them and push them away from society and just had enough of it and build their own alternative lifestyle? And that's why I love this book. Every time I read it, every single time, I find so many layers. It's really a masterpiece.
That's brilliant. So let's talk about your creations, because they span so many different realities. You know, they extend reality. They to me, sometimes pierce past the third dimension into the fourth, and might we consider a fifth? You know, I've fundamentally believed that we're at this place and time that because of the advances in technology, the Internet of Things, AI, blockchain, AR, VR, extended reality, all new devices, right? Sensors across supply chains, you name it, that we have entered, and what we are doing in reality is designing for the fourth dimension, right? Mm. If we actually think, yes, about this, that we are designing for space and time.
Yes.
Well, if we go back to the theory of relativity and NASA's, you know, okay of it more recently, it hits us and says, that's the fourth dimension. Talk to me a little bit about some of the creations that maybe have taken you into that new dimension.
So a big part of what I do is experiential activation and looking into, you know, how will we experience this cross reality or cross boundary world, right? Because we, in one hand, we don't know what it looks like yet, because we are starting to create it right now. The infrastructure is laid out, right now or starting to be laid out. And now we are really experiencing this crossover. So I want to say at right now, for example, I'm obsessed with nipples. I'm sorry to say it, but I am obsessed with nipples.
They are a beautiful thing.
They are a beautiful thing. And it actually all started. So I'll take you through a path of like my nipple session.
Well, let's talk about, can we just like move past like, yes, it's a part of anatomy, but it's a part of anatomy that is extrasensory.
Yeah. And
like if we're getting to multi-sensory experiences,
yeah.
Like let's start with the human body and where are our most receptive senses?
Yeah. And why do we choose to accept some and reject others, right? So
right.
It actually all started from Travis, the rapper, had a Fortnite concert, a famous like VR concert with his avatar. And his avatar had no nipples. And there was like a little nipple gate thing happening in like the back door of the internet of like, why doesn't the avatar have nipples? And I'll also ask myself, why is a digital representation of self is deprived of physiological? If you're going to make, you know, an embodied or a body-like avatar, why would you exclude the nipples? And I thought that was the beginning of COVID. And I thought it would be funny to do a speaking nipple AR lens. Everybody were doing like the speaking gherking, I think. And I was like, what if I was like a speaking nipple on my Zoom calls? And I made this AR filter where you could see me speaking. And it got banned within 37 minutes. I kid you not. And I was like, wow, that's just so weird because it's just one disembodied nipple. So I did another version, which was a cluster of pixelated nipples that you have like shoot spawn from your mouth when you speak. That was blocked as well. It took a bit longer, but it was blocked. And I'm like, but it's pixelated. Why are we so sensitive about it? I ended up writing an academic paper about it called Free the Virtual Nipple. And the reception was really interesting because people are like, hey, we never thought about it. My next phase, which I just finished, was to do this little animation. And my next phase is to make it into an interactive game. So I like to like every process that I make, I guess this is equivalent to I want to say an innovation process that I started by prototyping. And I saw the reaction for that. And then I did my research based on the prototyping. And now I'm doing the pilot, the MVP. And my next one will to do this product that makes people not just talk about why do we care about it, but experience it and be in it. Because I think there are a lot of products and design experiences that are targeting the audience to feel a specific thing or to be engaged through a specific behavior. For example, the notifications we get on our phone, they're meant to make us panic a little bit. So we will engage more. So, you know, the advertising dollars will, there's more eyeballs, more dollars. I'm trying to create spaces where people explore these notions and choose to participate or not. I like to say, I like to create sandboxes. And not games, because I'm curious how people will react to it. And that's what I'm doing. So this is just one topic. I have another project that I'm busy with that I can't release, but we're going to do a big tech hackathon, but it's related to kids and play agency that will come out in October. So again, I just like to make sandboxes, right? I like to create these spaces where I do the tools to the best of my understanding, but I also let the people play with it, because playing with platforms, digital and physical, is how we learn to be in the world.
What's one of the toughest problem spaces that you've encountered in your explorations?
I want to say financing. It's very hard to finance exploration. I want to say pure exploration. Mm-hmm. Because even when you go to organization and funds that are, you know, there are in it or into it, most of them are truly, you know, financial entities, and they need to maintain themselves. So you have to be really clear on the return of an investment. And the more tangible it is, aka it's going to be a product that will do this and you will benefit like that, it's easier to get funding. It's much, much harder when you're saying I'm exploring it outside academia, right? Academia is built just for research, but then it's detached from, you know, I don't want to say it's not detached from the real world, but it has very specific parameters that confine it to the research world. I'm doing my PhD at York University, and my PhD is actually a research creation. So my creation will be the research process and how people experience it, but that's not very common. So to find this space between, and that's why we call the company Future Memory Inc. We're looking into the future from the collective memory and heritage behaviors and trying to figure out how to incorporate it in the real world, not for profit, but for true advancement. And that kind of activity is very hard to, people get it, people like it, but not a lot of people are willing to sacrifice resources or finance to support it. And understandably so, they want to know what's in it for me. And I get it, but this is where my tribe of awesome people keeps me going, because I think there are a bunch of people right now in the tech world that are not just tech, but let's say tech and research and design, that are looking for like a bigger cause, like a bigger real exploration, real research, real innovation outside of the walls of I don't want to say Silicon Valley, but you know, I want to say the startup bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just play with technology. That's very hard to find a space to where you can really play with technology, not just in your living room, or right now living room. I want to say garage, but right now with COVID still, it's the living room. And find a community around it. That's the extremely hard part, which I'm trying to build right now. And it's moving, because I think people realized they want more. They deserve more from technology, and they want more from technology. And the sense of wonder is not necessarily satisfied by another app that gets you something quicker or more efficiently. The sense of wonder comes from play and playfulness and exploration and asking the questions.
STEAM skills equip women and girls to participate in the global workforce. Yet in 2021, only 27% of scientists, technologists, engineers, artists, mathematicians, and designers were women. This is why DesignByUs.org is committed to closing the gender and pay gap, enabling 10 million women and girls to take command of the command line and change the world for good. Last year, your donations helped the Design Corps fight climate change, COVID-19, and disinformation on the web. Your donations and investment help us meet this goal. I'm asking you to visit designbyus.org/donate. That's designebyus.org/donate, and make a donation today.
You've touched on it a couple of times, which is the Tribe of Awesome.
Yes.
How did you meet the Tribe of Awesome? Where do you find the Tribe of Awesome? Where do they come from?
They are everywhere, actually. Funny enough, like some people I met online, LinkedIn of all places. I'm very not shy on LinkedIn. If I find someone on LinkedIn that I really like what they think, I will try to connect with them and say, like, look, I really, really like what you're doing. Let's chat. I had some wonderful friendships that leaked into the real world from there. I met a lot of people. One of the reasons I do public speaking is, of course, to talk about ideas and methodology, but also I find conferences an amazing place to find like-minded people that are both on stage and off stage. This is like the real, everybody are there for that interest or reason. So I think a lot of connections are through there. Some, of course, people I worked with, and some just casual dog park friends. I'm a very open, like I meet people and I just want to bring them in. I'm a hugger. I used to be a hugger before COVID. I'm a very curious person about other people. So I think I just open, the doors are open to anyone, always. And I see every single person as someone that is potentially awesome, right? So I think, yeah, it's, there's hit and misses, of course, but I think if you're going to be talking about collective, you have to be collective and share your thoughts and resources. I hide nothing, from my practices, and my thoughts, and some people take it and run with it, without me, but that's perfectly fine. I don't feel like I own my knowledge. I only own what I can practice and express, and that's on me. But I'm a very non-reserved person.
Absolutely, and I think there is a beautiful to being unapologetically you.
Yeah, I mean, everyone else are taken. Who else are you going to be?
That's right. Well, it's so interesting that we as creatives, and I find in speaking with others, is they try on different ways of expressing themselves, but to be unapologetically you is the one that actually draws the most trust, right? Yeah. That truly solidifies the most trust in your ability to continuously create.
Yeah. And I want to just differentiate it between being unapologetically you and what I like to call the invisible creativity cloak, which a lot of people use in order to camouflage or explain very abusive behavior. Like, I'm a creative, you know, but I'm a creative. I can be abusive. This is my creative process. And I'm like, I don't like, there's a difference. You know, I'm seeing so many creatives, And my understanding of that is that I believe creativity always comes from, I want to say, absence or a sense that something is broken. You want to fix it. This sense of like, I can do it better. Not from ego, but I think it can be done better. And I think a lot of creatives start like that, but then they lose their own origin story of why they want to make it better. Mm-hmm. And they just get caught up with, I'm the only one that can fix it. You don't get it. And kind of start excluding people because they think they know better. They're the only ones that can do it better. And that's really bad. And I think eventually I see most of these kind of creatives ending up having this like midlife crisis where all of a sudden they create things out of, it's almost like a muscle, and they lost the connection to why, the wonder where they began. And yeah, that's when they lose themselves and they feel, and they go in, themselves into that black hole. So I want to say, like, I think it's admirable for people to try and fix the world or change the world, but not forgetting why you're doing it. So you won't become this, I'm like that. I'm an entrepreneur, so I can crush people. I know better. Look, I made all this money. Look at all the prizes and awards. And I'm like, yes, they're important. They are, you know, they signify that you achieved something, but they're not the core of it. The wonder and the curiosity and I think the will to really do it better for more people than yourselves is what should drive creativity and technology and basically everything.
Totally agree with you. Totally agree. As we kind of start to drill in, I'd love to get into what inspires you. Like, where do you You know, where do you go for that inspiration?
Ooh, I'm a culture junkie. So I consume a lot of media, a lot of film. I'm a very visual person. So I watch the Kardashians, know everything about them, because I believe this is a cultural phenomenon that we can't ignore. And I watch, you know, The Wire, and I watch, like, you know,
Those are some of my favorites. Yeah, The Wire is one of the most underrated, most brilliantly written stories.
I just started watching it after years because I kept getting hung up on, like, the second or third episode of the first season. I'm like, why are everybody so into it? And I'm now in season four, and I'm like, holy shmoly, this is so good, because it's one of these, it's one of these multi-layered series that they don't just tell, you know, they don't get caught up with the black and white. Like, police is good and drug dealers are bad, but they really show the complexity of a situation in a specific ecosystem, which we're, you know, the characters are all part of. And it's incredibly harsh in the sense that it shows things as it is, and very nuanced and delicate in showing the characters and their reactions. So these are the kind of things I like. I actually started watching again a lot of late 90s, like my growing up. I'm doing like a period now of revisiting my growing up, like mythical or things that I think that shape my life. So I'm reading again books that I read when I was 14 and 15. I'm seeing movies again to see, you know, to refine these paths and kind of like connect what influenced me, because I'm a mirror of what I grew up with.
Gotcha. So we talked about what inspires you. Who inspires you?
Again, my aha moment was actually I met a creative director in one of the companies I was consulting to. His name is Roger Gerards, and it was a textile company. They do African wax prints. And he is the person that really aha'd me about creativity and leadership. Because up until then, you know, most of the creative directors and creative people I met were like, I did this and, you know, and I want to say put themselves in the middle of the creation. This guy, which is a phenomenal creative and with a background in anthropology, I never seen a presentation of his that he didn't credit first the designers that did it and then himself. And for me, that was shocking. That was shocking. I never experienced it in all the industries that work, from product design to fashion to jewelry, business, education, somebody that puts the others before himself. And I told him that, and he said, but that's normal. I'm just a part of it. And this is where my personal sense of frustration that I had before from I want to say design organizations or companies kind of like surfaced. And I said to myself, well, it doesn't have to be like that. You can do it differently. You can be creative and open and collaborative. You can hone it and be successful. But I think people think it's either or, like you either take it, right, or you give it up. And that was an amazing experience, because it really taught me that you can do both. You can take it and share it, and it's a collective effort, right? So I think it really impacted my life. But besides that, I just love creators like Taika Waititi. I love him. Been following him for years, even before Jojo Rabbit. I think he's a phenomenal creator, content creator, because he's unafraid to dismantle very complex and sensitive issues and make them fun and visual and acceptable to debate. I remember.
Yeah, no. I mean, Jojo Rabbit was brilliant. Like, just, you know.
He was, you know, I'm Israeli Jewish and
yeah, and I'm American Jewish. And those are things that we never joke about, right? There's not even, you don't even poke at it.
Well,
and it was artful, at least here,
not in public.
In the times we're
not
living around. That's
you
right.
You have like
that's
these
right.
little banters, but you don't want to expose it into like public debate, because that will be disrespectful.
You're right. But in the privacy of our bacchanal with our fellow tribe members, we make that occasional joke. But this was public.
It was amazing. I watched it it was just before COVID. I watched it in a little cinema in Toronto in the beaches. And there weren't a lot of people there. And I remember me and my hubby were sitting there. We were laughing so hard because it was, you know, again, I don't want to quote it here because maybe people that haven't seen it, I don't want to ruin it but there's hilarious moments there. And we were laughing and I could see like people were really scared to laugh because, you know, this is a taboo subject. This is something you're not sure if you can, are you laughing at it? Are you laughing with it? Are you laughing after the fact? So I admire him for being able to, I want to say, dismantle this bomb without belittling it. I think that's a skill. And I think I aspire with what I do to do that, to take things deeply. But taking things deeply doesn't mean they have to be serious and heavy. You can look at something deeply with a lighthearted approach and an open approach. So I admire him for being able to do that.
Totally agree. It is inspiring to see when someone can do that. There is something so incredibly special about it. And there was nothing, at least I certainly didn't find it offensive. You know, in a time where we, you know, the hot topic of the day is who is getting canceled. You immediately think, well, whoa, that's a topic that nobody would ever take on because for fear of. Yeah. And in reality, it was beautifully done.
Yeah. And I think that's probably one of the challenges of our time, because now we're talking about the fact that every continent, especially if we go back to this connected hybrid world where we have to figure out what is, you know, I don't want to say acceptable because everyone can accept or not accept something, but what works in a cross realm world. Something that works in my, I want to say my living room won't work in the whole white world. People are being judged for better and worse for small things that wouldn't be before, because every, you know, the boundary between the intimate, private, and public is blurred completely. Like people are sharing very personal things, you know, and very personal thoughts that, you know, wouldn't have been shared before. So all of a sudden they become public domain, but does it mean that the public owns it? And so these are, you know, just small things if we only talk about social media. But now let's talk about behaviors and features and representations that will go across, you know, from your physical to the digital. How do you want to represent yourself? Will you be judged for it? Are you trying to represent something that is authentic to you or not? We have all the layers of cultural appropriation, which I completely support, because I think there's a lot of, I want to say, unique cultures that have been exploited for the benefit of, you know, because, you know, white people find it interesting. So they feel like they can hone it. But on the other hand, if we segregate them, how do we do, I want to say, cross-cultural or global sense of participation in other cultures? Are we even able to do it? And it's a very loaded subject. You know, I'm in academia now, so there's a lot of post-colonial debate and discussion, and it's quite depressing to read, to be a reader in humanities these days, because you realize that even what we defined as humanity is normally just a Western white culture perception of what ethics is and what aesthetics are and what representation is. So you really have to unlearn a lot of things. I hope we're in a period of unlearning, that we can move again into being able to step over the boundaries that you were born in. So, you know,
I'm with you, but how do we achieve a period of unlearning without the anti-intellectualism piece of it, right? Because it's interesting that seems intertwined in it right now is a sense of anti intellectualism. And I don't know if that's being driven by bigger forces that are kind of anti-establishment, right? Anything, if it's big business, it's, you know, anything big is not good right now, right? It is not in culture.
Well, there's distrust, of course. There's a cultural distrust between, I don't want to call it tribes, but between different streams of thought in society. And I think in order to maybe we have to be less intellectual, you know, because intellect and reason are great things. They're also a colonial symptom, right? Because it all started from the idea that human is rational and thus superior to, you know, animals, or superior to men, or superior to women because they're rational, women are emotional, or to indigenous and marginalized people because they're closer to nature. So I'm all for knowledge, and I want to separate intellect from knowledge. There are different layers of knowledge, and I think one of the most beautiful things I've read in the Old Testament was, actually, it's not the Old Testament, it's one of the other Bible books, because the Old Testament is the five books, but it was about King Solomon, and they said he was the wisest of all people because he could speak in 70 languages. And the interpretation of that is not that he could speak different, you know, he could speak the ancient Hebrew, etc., but he could speak to every person on their level. So, and I think this is a skill that is very hard to own, and we need to recognize that intellect and knowledge are valuable, and this is what arguably made humanity progress, but it's not the only way we operate. There's emotion, there's survival mode, there's trust and distrust, and if we don't build all the other things, using reason alone is not enough. So again, you know, I was very disturbed in the last couple of years on the attack of, I want to say, intellect and science as a valid tool, full stop. But it also taught me that there's a massive distrust and doubt about the benefits they bring and the assurance they bring to demographics that don't necessarily live their lives around these ethics. So we need to find out how to connect the dots. And it's very hard because, you know, I wish it was as easy as like, oh, we'll just do this. But it first takes the effort of, you know, a joint effort from all sides to just, you know, get off the high horse. I actually used to like, and these days I hate the idea of, you know, if you got to the top floor, send the elevator down. I think it's a terrible.
Yeah, it's a terrible mess. No.
Yeah,
no,
because I'm like, I'm in the penthouse now, coming up and rise to me. And I'm like, no, get. If you want people to be in the top floor, you get down and give your space to them, or just get down to where they're at and figure out what they need. Maybe they don't need the top floor. Maybe they need, I know, running water.
Yeah, this is where I push back and say that I actually believe that hierarchy, is such a Western belief, as opposed to, I look at, I don't want to build a ladder. I want to build a bridge. And that to me, right, is the idea of linking, not ranking.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, it's really odd because when I started with immersive tech, you know, I used to call myself a digital hippie. They said, I believe that technology is awesome, but also humans are awesome. And people used to, you know, especially from, you know, I want to say the Tech Boys Club. Do you call it? Yeah. I'll tell you.
I live that on a daily basis. Now, I'm very fortunate that, you know, whether in Design by Us, we are multicultural, multiracial, all genders. And there's a lovely balance to that. But when I, you know, have that day life of being inside of big tech, It's there. Yes. And no matter whether you have a few females in this, it's still ingrained in the model.
And I find it fascinating, but you probably got to know me. The more somebody tells me it can't be done, the more I'm going to try and figure out a way to do it.
Yeah.
So they don't know. They're just fueling my engines. I'm like, what's next? And that's why, NIPT, came to place. It's a kind of a softer version of like why, and this is, I think, what I will be doing in the next 2 years, just asking, why is this taboo? Why can't we say this? Why can't we show it? Why in virtual space we need to represent ourselves as we are in real life. So recently there was an activist that I really like, and she made one of the online virtual platforms allow the avatars to have burqas. And I totally respect that. But that also made me ask, like, why do we transfer these physical behavior and social codes into this space that is supposed to be liberating and free and free us from the physical, I want to say, representation or restrictions? And will we even be able to detach the two or see this as an alternate space, or will it be an extension of what we already have? Mm-hmm. And again, we saw it in social media. Yes, I find technology to be a lens, that let us focus on specific, topics and behaviors and I want to say life, aspects of life, but it also enhances them. So the good, the bad, the weird, we really should treat technology it's not the destination. That's not the destination. That's a tool that will help us get to this destination. Being Instagram famous, with that staying on Instagram without real life implication, whether financial or personal or whatever, professional, is not, doesn't do anything, to be honest. It's only when we can translate it back to the real world. And a lot of developers forget that connection, forget that we're forever in our bodies. Let's talk about reality, physical reality, and dimensionality. We are. And reality is what we experience through our senses and our bodies, full stop. Mm-hmm. I'm certain as an academic, but also as a person, that there are layers that are not familiar to me and known to me because this physical expression is limited. Mm-hmm. For example, your life, Joanna, I don't know, your reality is your reality. My reality is mine. Maybe they'll collide. But these are two, separate universes that we're both experiencing simultaneously. So let's talk about the physical, the very basic, the same plane physical experience. We are all having a completely different experience of life, everyone. So we're already living in our own omniverses, and understanding it helps you to also understand, why do people don't behave the way I expect them to? Well, because they're not you. But also to respect it, and not try to make them necessarily come to your world, but to visit their worlds and to enable them to live their best human lives, because we are also finite, which is something that a lot of devs refuse to accept. Like, they're like, forever young and live forever. I'm like, the finite existence is what's, in my mind, beautiful in our lives, because we know we have an expiration date on this dimension. So this is now the question: how do you want to live your life? Do you want to take it all in? Do you want to give it all? Do you want to balance it? This is a personal choice, but it is a choice that you take. And this is what I'm trying to do through my work. I'm trying to realize that I'm limited. I'm confined to my own experience, but that's also beautiful and wonderful, and it allows me to express it. But I also aspire to learn more about all these universes and realms, digital, physical, mental, personal, of other people. This is my attempt of having meaning through this life. So I'm completely YOLO, really. I think people underestimate millennials and Gen Z. YOLO is genius. because it's true, you only live once, as far as we know. So, you know, this is the question. What is your purpose in life? You know, whatever it is, just know it. That's like the first thing for anyone, whether they're accountants or creatives or scientists, to really ask themselves that. This is our duty, I think, right? To figure out why we're doing this, why we're here, what we're trying to achieve. Whatever the answer is, it's fine, but be honest with yourself. And that's freedom. For me, this is freedom, the ultimate freedom of human spirit, knowing or at least researching or asking yourself why you're here and trying to express the answer through your actions.
Thank you so much for sharing the journey that has informed your vision of humans in the digital space. And thanks for reminding me about the power of connection that we must build into the universes that we select to operate in. And to our listeners, thank you for sharing your mind space and time. Until next time, I dare you to design an inclusive future today. Designed by Dot Show is written and produced by the Design Corps at Aurora 21 Studios. Podcast producer, audio engineer, and original music by Rachel Bickley. Commercial voice talent by Angelo Giannone. And I'm your host, Joanna Pena Bickley.